Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, April 11th at 1:34 in the afternoon. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance, once again, a full House. Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, Senator Myers, Senator Hughes, and myself as chair, Senator Holland. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Talia, our moderator for today. And as a reminder, if you have your cell phones on board, please silence your cell phones. First up today is Senate Bill 207, Access to Marijuana Records. I'll bring it back before the committee. This is the second hearing on Senate Bill 207 in Senate Judiciary. I'm going to open it up for public testimony. Senate Bill 207 is open up for public testimony. Does anyone in the room wish to offer public testimony on Senate Bill 207? Seeing no one in the room, is anyone online on 207? Make sure I'm looking at the right stuff. Looks like no one online. So no one online is going to be offering public testimony on 207. At this time, I'll close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. Do members have any questions for the sponsor or comments on the bill? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At our last meeting when we discussed this bill, I raised some questions about some other ordinances that included things that are legal today but might have been included in this bill. And in walking through the statutes that have those with advocates for the bill, what we found was those statutes have a bunch of stuff in them. Stuff that is legal today, stuff that was protected under the Supreme Court provisions, and also stuff that would not be. So to include those, you'd have to get the staff in to look at past convictions and sort of tease out what was at issue, and it becomes unworkable, or at least it becomes very labor-intensive. So, Mr. Chairman, I think there was an excellent answer to my question, and I wanted to put it on the record, and so I think the bill as written is in good shape.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for the sponsor. When we last had this bill up, we talked a lot about background checks for employment. I think we might have touched on background checks for housing at one point. I know occasionally landlords will do background checks on their prospective tenants. I had somebody brought up to me an interesting question. How would this bill apply if a background check was being done on a person in the case of applying for legal guardianship or adoption?
Senator Schauer?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask for a lifeline on this one, perhaps Department of Law. She's going to love that view. Or Department of Public Safety. I'm seeing the finger pointing of patient duty work here, but
Ms. Howell, from a specific question. If you'd place yourself on the record and offer any insight you may have on that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. I may defer to Lisa Perrington. So the background checks that the Department of Public Safety does are for either employment purposes or employment in criminal justice purposes.
Elaborate.
Mr. Chairman, Kelly's looking at me. I was looking past her to see if the we have one of our lifelines as well that Claire may come up if she thought she had a good answer for that as well, just to have her at the table. But we'll wait and see what comes up.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
So did you have a question? I thought you had a question about the question.
I think I'm going to defer to Lisa Perrington, who oversees the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau. I think she has called in, and she can answer specifically to the background checks that would be conducted for the purpose of foster care or adoption.
All right. So I do see we have Lisa Perrington. And if you can hear me, please state your name and your affiliation and your location and put yourself on the record and then offer any answer to this question you may have.
Thank you. For the record, Lisa Perrington, Bureau Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau with the Department of Public Safety, calling in from Anchorage, through the chair to address Senator Myers' questions. For the purpose of adoption, a person would come in and request a full criminal history report for that record, and that would be outside of the scope of this. And so the convictions in that case for the marijuana convictions would be displayed on that particular background check.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sounds like we got to the answer on that one. Senator Hughes.
And in regard to that, Lisa, we learned, or it was discussed last week, some people maybe knew, or already knew, it was new to me, though, that even if this bill were to pass, that a person could walk in and get the full records. And so that's great for someone who is in the proximity of a courthouse. What if someone wants the full records? Can they write or call, email a request, or do physically have to go in to get that? I guess that's not a Lisa question. That's a Nancy Mead question. I'm just wondering about the people. Not everyone is close to a courthouse. So I'm just wondering if someone needed the full records, whether they could still get them.
Nancy Mead, do you care to come to the presenter's table and offer some insight on Senator Hughes' question?
Yes, thank you for the record. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. beg your pardon. So under this bill, the people would not see from home on court view these marijuana records that are taken off. However, they would be available at a courthouse, as discussed previously. People could go to any courthouse in the state, and there are special kiosks where all the cases are on there, what we call our unpublished cases. This would be unpublished. And to directly answer your question, if a person cannot access a courthouse at all, we don't answer those questions over the telephone, so they would need to contact somebody. But we do have courthouses in 42 different locations. So we do our best in that regard. We don't have the staff to individually answer people's records requests.
Follow up. So if they write a letter, do they get the information back, or they have, if they're not in proximity, they'd have to send somebody else to the courthouse physically?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, I am not certain how courts would handle that. I think it might be different. The small courthouses with sufficient staff and time would likely be able to go ahead and respond to such a letter. In Anchorage, I'm fairly certain that a letter like that would not be able to be accommodated with our staff in the press of business.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schauer.
Just to follow up, Nancy, because that's a good question, Senator Hughes. If, let's say it was a business, so they were looking for a business and they were looking at background checks, would they be able to send a surrogate to do that at the kiosk? So it doesn't have to be the person, say a business owner hires a lawyer or an investigator. Would they have the ability to go to that kiosk for them in place of that actual person to get those records? So it doesn't matter who it is necessarily. Would that be true or false?
Through the chair to Senator Schauer, that's absolutely true. They are just public kiosks in the courtroom or in the court lobby that will have all the unpublished cases on them, as well as, so it's just a more expanded version of your court view that you see at home.
Thank you.
All right.
And
thank
I'll
you.
Just make a comment as follow-up.
Thank
you. So, you know, and I'm always concerned about, kind of equal access there, and just if someone couldn't physically get there, if they could find a surrogate, an employer who maybe really doesn't want to just buy court view for some reason, having to do with their business is important to them to have the full record. And they could send a surrogate, but that's not always practical. So it is kind of concerning to me that with the geographical expanse of our state, 42 communities, those are going to be hub communities, there would be certain times where it might be kind of tough for someone to get in, you know, to get that information. Could you find out for sure what the general practice is if a formal letter were written, whether they could get that information? It seems like, you know, if some can get it, that anyone who needs to get it that physically can't get in should be able to access it.
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, if I could make a comment about that. This bill has two completely different things. So I'm just talking about the court view piece. Court view, we recognize, is used for background checks, but it is not a place you go for a criminal background check. it's information that's not audited. It depends on the input of, you know, range 10 and 12 clerks. And it exists for our case management purposes. We recognize that some landlords refer to it. It's because it's darn good. And people refer to it when they're dating somebody and perhaps for employment purposes. If somebody really cares about a criminal background check, they need to go to the Department of Public Safety and get the background check that's dealt with in the rest of this bill. And that is not going to a courthouse or anything. That has nothing to do with the court. If somebody cares a lot for absolutely precise information, that's where somebody goes for a criminal background check. They have, you know, federal funding, and they communicate with the FBI. Court view is not intended for that purpose, I guess I'd say.
Thank you. And follow-up, that's very, very helpful, very helpful. So could I ask a quick of Ms. Purinton then? So Ms. Purinton, so if there is somebody that can't go to one of these kiosks in the courthouse easily, can they call or send a letter and get that information from the Department of Public Safety if they want a thorough, complete background check, no matter who it is? I know certain categories they would get it, but, you know, it's a small business owner. He or she just really cares and wants to know. Would you provide that information to any public member requesting it?
For the record, Lisa Purinton again with the Department of Public Safety, through the chair to Senator Hughes' question. Criminal records for the individual are confidential, and we would only release the information with a signed waiver by the individual authorizing the release of the information. And so in the case of not being physically present, certainly the individual can come in to any Department of Public Safety location to request a copy of their background check. For those that cannot physically come into the location, we do have a mail-in option. So there's an online form the individual would fill out. If they wanted that information shared with their landlord or whomever else they wanted that information to be shared with, they would just sign the release as part of that form, and then we would mail a copy both to the individual and to the person they authorized us to release the information to.
Okay, thank you. So, and just so I understand, so it's accessible if the person releases the information, the individual for which the background information is being requested. So they have to. So a business owner and landlord just can't get it unless they get the permission of the person. That's correct. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes. Yes, that is correct. The individual just have to sign the release to allow us to authorize the sharing that information with whomever they had requested.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Ms. Purinton. Are there any other questions for the sponsor or comments on the bill? Thank you, Ms. Mead. Let's see. At this point, I'm going to set an amendment deadline for Senate Bill 207 for 12 p.m. on Wednesday, April 13th, and I will set 207 aside. All right. Next up is House Bill 157. Back before the committee, this is the third hearing on House Bill 157 relating to reporting requirements for referenda and recall campaigns. And at the last meeting, we adopted a committee substitute and two amendments. We had another amendment that was withdrawn for a little bit of additional thought on it. We have another amendment to consider in its place. And I will move amendment number 4, labeled G.4, which is Does everyone have a copy of that? So I move amendment number 4, labeled G.4. Is there an objection?
I object for purposes of debate, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, thank you. Thank you, Senator Schauer. All right, so amendment number 4, labeled G.4, is this amendment takes an alternative approach to what amendment number 3 was trying to accomplish. Under this approach, penalties for a candidate making mistakes on their reports would be limited to 20% of the total contributions received by the campaign. This limit intentionally excludes large independent expenditure groups that are generally well-funded and run by sophisticated treasurers. The intent here is to remove an obstacle that could prevent a candidate from running for office due to the large potential fines for making an inadvertent mistake. While limiting the penalty limit for candidates but not political groups, may open a door for equal protection challenge. I believe that a public purpose served by making this distinction justifies classification. I also believe that individual candidates and large political action groups are not similarly situated, further justifying the different treatment. If you look at the amendment number 4, labeled G.4, the wording on this is on the bottom of page 2. Does anyone, is there any comment, Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the wording and trying to make sure, nail down what it covers. The wording is inadvertently committed by a candidate. And what I'm wondering about is, so for example, in my last race, I had a volunteer serving as treasurer who was handling most of the APOC paperwork. When we say committed by a candidate, would that also include work done by somebody who is working on that candidate's campaign?
I smell a conceptual amendment. No? All right. We have Ms. Kieneman, who may have some insight to offer on that. Please put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Rasmussen. Senator Meyer, to answer your question, AS 1513-400, the definition section that deals with candidates, it means an individual who files for election, and it also includes a candidate's campaign treasurer and deputy campaign treasurer, a member of the candidate's immediate family, a person acting as an agent for the candidate, the candidate's campaign committee, and a group that makes expenditures or receives contributions with the authorization or consent expressed or implied under the control, indirect or direct, of the candidate.
That is truly appreciated, Ms. Kieneman. Is there any further questions, Senator Myers? Is there any other question, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the approach in the amendment. I just want to make sure, generally my observation as a casual observer of APOC is that when you've got inadvertent or first-timer type mistakes, they're not getting up to 20% now. I just want to make sure this amendment is offered as a bar against a future commission going off the rails as opposed to a target.
What was the last word?
A target. We're not asking them to get to 20?
No. You are correct.
Thank you,
Senator Keel. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just, as the original kind of sponsor of Amendment 3, which this is a different version of it, I appreciate the approach. It makes sense to me. The question we had about, I mean, you could almost go 20% even for, I guess, large groups if you want to go there because they have bigger pockets. So, you know, 20% of a million, if they had that kind of money, or 20% of 50,000, depending on, you know, the level of it, would not be unreasonable. But I appreciate the approach. This kind of gets the intent across. I agree with Senator Keel that for the legislative intent on the record, is this is not to target somebody. This would be a maximum. I guess you could almost say shall not exceed, but may not exceed. But it's okay because I think the intent is on the record. We don't want them to go there. So thank you for the committee's work on taking care of a problem that we hadn't seen with the wording in the amendment. I think this achieves the goal. And the biggest thing was just not to disincentivize people from running because of the financial disincentive when they get hit with big fines. So I appreciate the work of the committee on this amendment and your staff as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Is there any further discussion on amendment number 4? Seeing none, Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
All right. Without further objection, amendment number 4, labeled G.4, is adopted. That is the end of submitted amendments. Are there further amendments from the committee? Seeing none, is there further debate on this bill? And seeing none, I will look to the vice chair for the will of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate committee substitute for committee substitute House Bill 157, Work Order 32-LS0669/Gulf, as amended, be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Without objection, Committee Substitute House Bill 157, as amended, has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes as amended. Do a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. And at this time, I will bring Senate Bill 229 back before the committee. It's related to state historical artifacts. This is the third hearing for Senate Bill 229 in this committee. And we do have a committee substitute for this bill. Senator Schauer, would you care to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 229 work order 32-GS2541/Gulf as our working document.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Senator Schauer, I will object for discussion. Mr. Mann, are you prepared to come up to the presenter's table to explain the changes in the committee substitute? Please put yourself on the record and discuss the changes in the committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers, filling in today. I will be reading a summary of changes for Senate Bill 229, version I to version G. Change 1, sections 1, 3, and 6 of version I were deleted. Change 2, the classifications were changed so that intentional violations of AS 41-35-200A or B are Class C felonies. And change 3, the definition of artifact was deleted.
Deleted?
Deleted.
Thank you. Are there any questions about the committee substitute? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Thank you, Mr. Mann. And without further objection, version G is our working document. Are there any further questions on this bill from the committee? Seeing none, there is an amendment by Senator Keel. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment 1, which comes from Legal Services, as G.1.
I will object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What Amendment number 1 does is puts a value on the felony threshold. Puts a threshold value on the felony. So I think probably inadvertently the way this bill comes to us, any artifact potentially is a felony. And I don't think that's what we intended. We're talking about most things, the baseline having been a misdemeanor, we want high value artifacts that are taken to rise to that higher level. And so what G.1 does, Amendment 1 does, the misdemeanors hang on to that knowing mental state, and the felonies, the intentional mental state. But then for it to hit the felony level, you have to remove or sell a historic, prehistoric, or archaeological resource worth $2,500 or more.
Thank you, Senator Keel. I'll just ask, was there a reason that you landed on $2,500 for the value of the artifact?
Mr. Chairman, that level, there's no magic in these numbers. And actually, I think there may be community discussion about whether that level is high enough to tip over from misdemeanor to felony. We wanted to make sure that somebody who picks up some railroad spikes or the little hexagonal tiles or who picks up something without knowing that it is somewhat valuable, while they still face criminal penalties, don't face a felony. Whereas someone who takes that thousands of years old basket from the dig site, it's pretty clear, right? That's worth a lot of money, and that should be the more serious level of conduct of penalty.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Schauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And we might this time to invite the Department of Law up for this one. We had a discussion ahead of time. So one of the genesis of this is that we kind of described before, I know it was on the phone last time it came up, is that there are assets of a certain class level that are very expensive. And it's, when you think about things like out of World War II, like an entire vehicle, for example,
That can be worth hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, depending on its intrinsic value and the condition it's in, et cetera. And when you're talking about some of those, and I was even describing to Senator Keel, I have some experience, for example, in Nevada of going to crash sites of military aircraft where just parts and pieces of them can be many thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars, because somebody might want it or they might have an asset that they would want it to replace, a part and a piece to use. So you could go for some of these assets if they were to find them in some of the old World War II sites where they might be, and it could be, you know, a very small widget. I just say that widget example is anything off of it, and it could be $5,000, $10,000, $12,000 for that little thing that he said, like a railroad spike, but something that comes off of a vehicle that could be like, oh wow, on the market, that's very expensive. When you put it out there, and I, like I said, I have a background to know how these can get very expensive, up into the asset itself of whatever it was, like say a World War II Jeep. So that might be $50,000 or $100,000 depending on the condition it's in for collectors that have money. So what we were really trying to do here was to, as Senator Keel said, was not cast the net so wide that we were hitting people that would go out and go, oh, look, they take a little piece of something because they found it, and the next thing you know, they're a felon when they put it out on the market or something. But at the same time, letting it be known that if somebody comes into the state, especially those that have money, and try to pull out whole assets that would be worth something to the state or to other programs or just the historic value of it, not being or being high enough on that threshold that they know that this is actually going to cause real legal trouble for them, i.e. the felony level. So that was really the discussion of not being so low, but having a, you know, it's just high enough that it would really keep average citizens that might go out and take something without in the back of their mind with criminal intent from becoming a long-term felon. I asked the Department of Law, Mr. Chair, because there was a discussion that we had originally, I believe, for $25,000 based on the next level of property crime and what that would be. And is there any issues with maybe saying, for example, I suggested perhaps, and we can talk about amending it, but maybe $15,000. Or would there, are there any equal protection or other issues the Department of Law might want to discuss on the level of this from that $25,000 we originally had to $2,500?
Did you hear the question there, Ms. Schroeder?
She knows.
Mr. Chairman. For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. For the Department of Law's position, where the committee sets the threshold is really a policy discussion. I'm unable to speak to the actual impacts on the ground, however, and I think I would defer to the Department of Natural Resources for any comment on that.
All right. Let me just check and see.
I was going to say, I would like to invite my staff up as well, a former Department of Natural Resources employee. And
Mr. Ogan, we have here in the room, please come to the presenter's table and offer any insight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Scott Ogan, Senior Policy Advisor to Senator Mike Schauer. Amongst other things, I have been in my past, besides being a recovering legislator, is I'm a recovering natural resource manager for Department of Natural Resources. And as such, I had two people on my staff that were under RSA with the Division of History and Archaeology Office, and we did a lot of research on navigable waters, and we were trying to prove which navigable waters belong to the state. So I have to my credit, which is really one of my funnest days, was when I found an artifact that in the eyes of the average person was probably not good for anything but firewood because it was an old boat. Excuse me. It was an old boat that actually was priceless for us. It had a real significant historical value. And this boat was a pulling boat that miners used to use. We were trying to lower the bar because BLM had this, you know, you can only, the river's only navigable if you have this big, huge boat, and, you know, and only the biggest rivers are navigable. We were trying to lower the bar because we had conflict going on in the 40-mile area of the Mosquito Fork, in particular, where we argued with BLM for 50 years over whether or not the state owned that river or the BLM. If it's not navigable, then the underlying property owner owns that river. And the issue was gold mining leases. So fast forward, we're out there trying to prove that that river is navigable and clear the title on those rivers and many, many others, hundreds or thousands of other rivers in the state. We found a boat that was the kind of boat the miners used to transport miners from Tanana to Chicken. And it was just a simple, like, hand-built canoe, and it was just some wood sticking up above the ground. It was like 8 inches of ground in it. So that, in my opinion, I mean, somebody might have looked at it and said, oh, there's some firewood, chop it up, you know, burn it. But that was probably worthless on the market. You know, I mean, it was scrap wood, basically. We ended up excavating that boat out. We hired a boat builder to do takeoff and lines. We got a naval architect that told us how much material that boat would carry, and we completely lowered the bar and changed the paradigm on how, what rivers are navigable that the state owns, and cleared up disputes that we've been fighting over since statehood with the feds. So I would argue just putting an arbitrary figure on the value or eliminating the definition of what an artifact is not wise. I would recommend that we put a definition that of artifact is for a felony purpose in addition to value, would be something that has significant historical value to the state. Because that old rotten boat that was so fragile, I had my archaeologists were digging it out with spoons, you know, and just completely exposed it. And we couldn't move it, but we took the lines off of it and, you know. So I think those kind of artifacts are worth protecting as well. So, and they may be valueless on the market.
Well, right now we're talking about the amendment and about $2,500, I believe, is the value on the amendment. And the question was, should we go with 15 or some other number? I'll just say for the record, I am comfortable with 2,500 because I was almost thinking something smaller, because there are many artifacts that may not be very old, but still military aircraft or something like that, and a small piece or part of it could be, it doesn't approach 2,500, but but I'm comfortable with the $2,500 amount. Senator Hughes.
Well, I'm hearing what Scott is sharing, that, you know, we think of the question then is, how do you determine the dollar value? Because what you described, you couldn't go on eBay and sell it and maybe get anything for it, but yet it did have significant value. Could that be translated into a monetary amount? It maybe could, depending on how you valued it. So I guess the question would probably be to DNR, if they had a dollar value for that, how would they do it? Would they consider what Scott just described as something, yeah, that would, even though you couldn't sell it, it would have a high dollar value for the purposes of the state. So I guess that's kind of the core question that we need to have answered.
And so Senator Keel's amendment does talk about the appraised value of the historic, prehistoric archaeological resource at the time and place of the crime is the value. We do have Judy Bittner. I believe she's the chief of history and archaeology with DNR. And Chief Bittner, if you could put yourself on the record and offer any insight on the conversation we're having right now.
For the record, my name is Judy Bittner, and I am the Chief of the Office of History and Archaeology in the Department of Natural Resources, and through the chair, answer the question on value. For archaeologists and historians, we often don't put a monetary market value on artifacts when we are trying to manage them, and it is really their intrinsic value in terms of the information that they yield and the site that they come from as well is important in understanding what information they can contribute. Mr. Ogun's example was, you know, next to a river, which they were trying to determine navigable, and the fact that it was located there and not someplace else, it gave an association to that. Some states look at the destruction or disturbance of a site from which an artifact was taken, and sometimes the value or the monetary I guess, the monetary value, you know, associated with that action. Often the amount of the cost of restoring that site and trying to determine how much information was lost from that site in terms of mitigating it, as opposed to the market value of the individual artifacts taken out of the site. Because a lot of the information that could be gained from that site would have been lost. And so there is sort of a significant value to that. The artifacts that end up in museums get valued, maybe for insurance purposes by museums. Placing a value on artifacts is not something that we do at the Office of History and Archaeology. So if there was a provision to put that value on it, for purposes of enforcement of the unlawful acts, we'd have to figure out within the state how to do that.
Ms. Bittner, here's a question. Do you think that the Office of History and Archaeology would be able to look at an item in the field and just be able to state whether the item was greater or less than the value of $2,500, as opposed to coming up with a specific dollar amount? I know you would probably think some items are priceless because of their location and because their condition and location. So would you be able to do at least something like that, just so it would be greater or less than $2,500 in value?
I don't think archaeologists in the field look at things in terms of monetary value, but in terms of contributing to the understanding of that site. So you can have little tiny microblades that are found, you know, from a 13,000-year-old site, and it would just give you information about the technology that they had and how they hunted, as opposed to how much a collective, set of microblades would be on the market. I just don't know any archaeologists that put monetary values on artifacts or the collection that they get from a site, but look at it for the information that it can yield.
Senator Sauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So we're talking a couple things here. One of them, if you have an artifact that is just something that, like a boat, that you can't really tell. I mean, that's intrinsic value. It may not have any on the market. We're also talking about equipment and things here, and that was really the genesis of this was, if you go, and I believe in Ms. Schroeder could tell us, I think 750 is the current limit for felony once you step above that for property crime. But when you talk property, we're really kind of talking somebody's property. This is a little different than, something that was abandoned by the federal government or the state government that's just out there somewhere, in a field or whatever, that, a crash site, you name it, whatever it might happen to be. And so we're talking about taking something that's a historic thing but wasn't really owned by anybody, or you could maybe say the state has it because it's on state land, for example. My concern with the lower number, and I understand, like I said, we're not really at odds here other than just maybe perhaps the amount in the discussion, is having done this myself, the things we're discussing, like artifacts that are not personal property but a Jeep or a truck or a plane or something like that, you start taking pieces of those, and like I said, having done that, $2,500 is nothing. That's gone like that. If somebody was to take a nut and a bolt or a widget or some railroad spikes, sure, that's not going to be much. But when you start taking pieces of historical equipment, then that number goes very fast on the market. I'm not even sure $15,000, for example, we had discussed would be enough, but I could not support such a low number, knowing this field a little bit, that you are going to exceed that number very, very quickly for the types of things we're discussing that aren't really personal property for a felony, but are these historical things that are out there somewhere with you. And quite frankly, if you step beyond that, and this was a thought process, if you go beyond $15,000 or $25,000 or whatever that number would be, you're talking about really starting to take a whole asset. You're bringing in a helicopter and taking a whole truck out or a whole plane out or a whole something, and that's a whole different level where we're trying to prevent somebody from doing that.
to take a whole artifact away from the state out of it, as opposed to somebody stumbling along going, oh, look, there's a Jeep. I'm going to take a steering wheel back home with me. That made sense. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Schauer. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been a great discussion, and I appreciate it very much. I very deeply value the historical records and the historical artifacts and historical value of those things. It's extremely difficult. I cannot think of a way to say which thing has what historical value in a way that could ever stand up in court, right? We the government cannot give a prosecutor discretion to say, well, this thing is just more historical in some undefined way than another thing. Otherwise, I would love to write that into the bill. So what we maintain, and the amendment does nothing to change, is that if you knowingly take something that's a historic, I forget the title, artifact of the state, archaeological resource of the state, that remains a Class A misdemeanor. I don't change that. That's the underlying CS we have in front of us. So there is a criminal penalty for that that microblade or flint nap knife or whatever we're discussing here. When we rise to the felony level, there needs to be some kind, I think, of threshold. So that it's, over the old Treadwell Mine had, for some reason, they called it a natatorium, not a swimming pool. Couldn't tell you why. The tiling were little white hexagonal tiles. And after the great giant cave-in in 1917, I think, they're strewn along the beach, right? And they're a very popular thing for people to go pick up. We don't want that to be a felony. They are a historical resource of the state. So the reason for, as Senator Schauer alluded to, the amendment proposing a higher threshold than theft, taking a wallet, rifle in somebody's car, is in part that it's so difficult for the layperson to know what they're going after, the value of a historic resource. And so the amendment, I appreciate you noting, Mr. Chairman, talks about the appraised value, and that's used for all sorts of things. That's used by museums. That's used in wills and estates. There's a category of non-saleable properties. You can imagine the things people find when someone passes away. The appraised value, right? In these sorts of prosecutions, someone has to come in as an expert witness and say, this is a valuable historic thing. So you've already got an expert witness. It's not a big additional deal to get them to also opine expert opinion as to the value of the thing, the appraised value of the thing. The question of where that appraised value should be to get to a felony level, I'm perfectly comfortable with Senator Schauer's suggestion to raise that so we don't catch the inadvertent. We do have the intentional standard in the amendment. So I'm perfectly happy to hear from other committee members about where that dollar threshold should be.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the amendment. I've got a couple questions for Ms. Schroeder. I'm thinking less about the dollar figure and more about the mental states that we've put into here. And so what I'd like to do is just kind of pose a few kind of hypotheticals to Ms. Schroeder to see where exactly this is going to fall in terms of the classification and the punishment. So my understanding of this is somebody goes out to a maybe they know it's an archaeological site, maybe they don't just yet, but they go out there, they find something that they like that they know that they can sell on eBay or somewhere else and get $5,000 or $10,000 off of it. So they pick that up and intentionally take it away for that reason. That is going to fall under the felony statute. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Senator Myers, they would have to be their conscious objective to take an artifact. So they would have to know what it was they were taking, and it had to be their conscious objective to take it. So under that fact pattern, it looks like that would fall under the intentional standard.
Okay, thank you. next up, let's say that somebody goes out to an area that may have some archaeological or historical value, and they find something that, let's say it is over $2,500 in value, but they don't necessarily know that. They find something, they know what it is,
and bring it home just as a keepsake. They have no intention of selling it. They just think it's something really cool. Maybe they don't do or don't know the value, but they at least know what it is. Would that fall under the felony or the misdemeanor or something else under this amendment?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, in the property crimes, the threshold, we do not have to prove a mental state as to the threshold. We have to prove the mental state that's required for the act, and then we do evaluation on what the stuff that is valued at. So we don't have to prove a mental state as to the monetary threshold.
Yeah, I understand. I kind of understand that. What I'm trying to get at is in the mental state of somebody who knows what it is. Maybe they do, maybe they don't know the monetary value, but they know what it is, and they're still taking it home with them. Which of those mental states would that fall under?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, the knowing mental state is that the person has not is aware of a substantial probability of its existence, unless they actually believe that it does not exist. So unless they actually believed it was not an artifact, that they would probably meet the knowing standard, but under your hypothetical, they may also meet the intentional mental state as well.
Okay. And then one more. Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you for your indulgence. So let's say somebody walks out, they're just on a hike across state land, maybe it used to be a mining claim, and they find maybe an old gold pan or something like that from 100 years ago. Take it home with them. Just thinking it's cool. Not thinking anything about its historical significance, anything like that. Just like the look of it. Where would that fall then?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, under that fact pattern, there would not be a crime.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Casey. So along the same line of questioning there, as we delineate these out, first question, two parts, is how often does this actually happen? I'm guessing this is fairly rare that, you know, somebody takes a widget, does that, anybody goes after him, SWAT, you know, doesn't show up in black SUVs at 2 o'clock in the morning. Although we know that it's happened at times for certain things, rings of it and other stuff. But what I'm really addressing is where this really would apply, most likely would be somebody comes in with a knowing fact pattern of wanting, you know, an asset, for example, something big, something that was discovered, and somebody comes in, I'm taking that. And they come in with people and resources and take that thing out of here in a barge. Well, that's pretty obvious that they're here taking something from the state as opposed to the wanderer, you know, that was out there and just saw some gold. That's cool. I'm going to take that home. Very different things we're discussing. I could see the state going after and trying to prosecute somebody for coming out and doing something that would be such a big operation. Do you see this? I guess the question, Mr. Chairman, is to the Department of Law. Is this really the low level things we're talking about a problem compared to what we're really trying to address, which is people taking very significant historical things out of the state?
Through the chair to Senator Schauer, I can't tell you how often it happens. I can tell you that DNR may actually have a better sense of how often it happens than I do, but I can tell you that in the entire time that we've been tracking cases, we have had 2 referrals. And I have reviewed those files, and in my opinion, those files definitely meet an intentional standard.
So who did you say to go to checkups?
The Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, back to Judy Bittner. Chief Bittner, if you can hear me, if you heard that question from Senator Schauer about how often do these sort of infractions, how often does it seem like we're chasing people down for walking off with state artifacts from state lands?
For the record, this is Judy Bittner with the Office of History and Archaeology, and through the chair to Senator Showers. I think it happens quite often, but it happens in remote areas, where it's very difficult to have, to catch anybody actually doing it. We see a lot of evidence of sites being dug up and artifacts taken. But it's very difficult to have somebody in place to actually witness that. We have had we have some joint operations with the federal agencies, and often the state will cooperate with them. And we do find evidence on social media. People will take videos of themselves and posting it as they use metal detectors in old, like gold rush towns, and are digging up artifacts, and will post that of, you know, this is a way to do that, and then it gets into the market there, but it's very difficult to actually prosecute those. I think what we're looking at, and I think some of the intent is to get at those that have a repetitive kind of pattern of digging up sites, and it is just part of their business to do so. Also, there's just some targeted big operations, like collecting World War II airplane parts, and we have intervened not very often, but during my career here, and retrieved the artifacts, but had not gone further to prosecute, but just retrieved the artifacts for the state. So it's difficult to enforce, because I think just the nature of it and the remoteness of many of the sites, but it's important, I think, to have the unlawful acts on the books and some sort of penalties to go with it.
Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Senator Shower had asked what the committee members would be comfortable with as a dollar amount. I'll restate that I was comfortable with $2,500. I still am comfortable with $2,500. I think it's pretty easy to look at it. I walked Treadwell this weekend. It's pretty easy to walk down there and look at rusted stuff and say that is clearly not worth $2,500. But what do I know? I think that a good low value makes it, it's not incredible. I just worry about going $15,000. That's where, you know, you would really, I think, have to be an appraiser of artifacts to be able to get some fine finesse on something of that magnitude. But I'm okay with $2,500. Senator Hughes.
Well, I'm not quite ready to answer that question, because what I'm wondering, Ms. Bittner, is that you had stated earlier that's not something you do, assign monetary value. So I'm wondering whether, if this amendment were to pass, is it going to trigger a fiscal note and a finance referral, because you will have to have an official appraiser determine the value. And then a very related question that will be for Ms. Schroeder is, if they don't have an official appraise, something done by, you know, a certified licensed appraiser, is that going to be a problem on the legal end? That historian, that archaeologist was just kind of guesstimating a figure. And so is that going to create a legal problem, especially if it's in the neighborhood near 2500? So the first question is for Ms. Bittner, as far as, is it going to trigger a fiscal note? And second question is for Ms. Schroeder, if there's not an official appraisal done, is that going to be a legal problem?
Ms. Bittner?
For the record, this is Judy Bittner, and through the chair to Senator Hughes. I'd have to look into it within the state and to see if there is that expertise within the state system, you know, at the State Museum or at the University of Alaska, and what that would entail. So I don't know at this point if it would trigger a fiscal note, and if there are resources within the state that we could call upon to assist us. Also look to our federal partners as they enforce their historic preservation laws as well.
Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Ms. Schroeder?
The Chair, Senator Hughes, because of the way the amendment is drafted, it says that it is the appraised value of the historic, prehistoric, or archaeological resource, so we would have to have the appraised value, and guesstimates are not going to get us there. We do have to have some sort of valuation in order to prove that element of the offense.
Senator Keel. To follow up on that, though, I mean, in terms of the approach and whether we're adding state resources here, my sense is that generally an agency that oversees something like this will refer a criminal behavior and not itself engage in appraisals of the exact value when they say someone has broken this law we're charged with overseeing, and that only if prosecutors take the case, then they would build out the record necessary to prove the elements. So, I mean, do I have that wrong? Am I misunderstanding the relationship between line agencies in these cases and the Department of Law?
Through the Sheriff, Senator Keel, in a case such as this, an officer or some sort of investigator would be putting the case together, and as they're putting the case together, an element of the offense would be the valuation, and so they would be attempting to gather that and then send the packet up to us as prosecutors to review. And we would probably have to call the person who did the valuation as a witness at trial, of course, but a lot of that is done at the investigation level.
Senator Schauer may have a follow-up to that.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions here, but I'm ready to maybe propose a conceptual amendment when the questions are answered. But I think a higher limit would still help with some of this because you would have less of this. It would be something more significant if you ever got to this question of who was having to make this decision and how often, what would happen. But I can tell you, as a matter of course, having, like I said, done this, of the aviation sites, and these were crash sites, right? Not even a lot of the things we're talking about are whole assets that were just left there that would be in better value or better condition. There wasn't one single thing we ever took from these sites that was less than that $2,500 amount. They were all worth, and some were much more than that. So I just think that depending on what it is and the level of it, that you would be probably upping the amount of work, in fact, and having to cause this if we go to that level for what's happening, because I guess, according to her, it happens more than I thought it did, that we're just not going after it based on the level and where they sit. So I just caution the committee that I think this is I think $2,500 might be a bit low for what we're talking about here, and I will propose a conceptual amendment when the time is ready. Thank you.
Senator Hughes?
And so, because you would, an official appraisal would need to be done, and you just explained how it worked to Senator Keel, the state's going to pay for it one way or the other, whether DNR does it or Department of Law. There will be a cost to it. So, yeah, I just wanted to get that on the record because it's a little confusing. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Is there any further discussion? Senator Schauer, did you want to discuss a conceptual amendment to this amendment?
I would like to do that, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Something to the effect of where Senator Keel has on his, so it's line 7 at the end of it, where it says equal or greater than 2,500. I would propose something along the lines of 10,000 or greater than, or let me read it right, equal to or greater than 10,000 or of significant historical value to the state. And if we were getting into cases like that, then you might have to get the appraisals and other types of things. But at least it would rise it to a higher level that would raise this threshold and I think get at us more of this noise level of what we're discussing. It's quite a bit less than what it would have been at 25,000, but it's four times the current as the amendment is written. And I think it would tighten the net up enough that it would take us out of most of this until we're really talking about things of significant value. And I did discuss this with the sponsor of the amendment, and I think we could agree perhaps to that, but it's, of course, the will of the committee, but I think I could certainly live with that language. I'm uncomfortable going as low as we are, so I would suggest it as a conceptual amendment, 10,000 or of significant historical value to the state.
I'll invite Mr. King to the presenter's table. I think he has a little bit of input on that in particular, your conceptual amendment. We'll see what Mr. King has to offer. Thank you. Conceptual amendment description. I object. All right. Would you care to speak here?
I could make an actual. We were discussing it. I didn't actually. I can make an actual proposal if you would like.
I do believe we have it replace the numbers 2,500 with $10,000 or of significant value to the state.
Okay. I'm good with that.
Significant value.
Historical value.
Okay. Significant. Mr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for the record, Ed King, Staff Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that the conceptual amendment needs to be read in conjunction with the existing law. And I would point to AS 1435230, paragraph 2, which is the definition of historic, prehistoric, and archaeological resources, which includes deposit structures, ruined sites, buildings, graves, artifacts, fossils, and other objects of antiquity which provide information pertaining to the historical or prehistorical culture of the people of the state as well as to the natural history of the state. And so maybe Ms. Schroeder can discuss how that amendment might interplay with existing law.
Ms. Schroeder? Thank you, Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, raising the threshold to $10,000, I think, creates the same issues that we've already discussed. I would have to defer to the Department of Natural Resources and whether or not they would be able to articulate significant historical value to the state, because that would then be, again, an element of the offense that we would have to prove. And we would likely have to call an expert, probably from the department. So I defer to them about whether or not that is something that they can articulate.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Is there any other question or comment from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, just one, and it takes us back full circle. We had started this with the intent of just saying World War II artifacts, because that was really where we were at. This kind of morphed and changed away from that. Quite frankly, I could be happy to go back to that, which really tightens up the time frame of what we're talking about. It got expanded and into all these different things and really stripped back down. So that may or may not be palatable or a good answer based on where we are, but that meant the initial intent. That's what we were trying to do, was to protect those World War II type assets that we knew were very valuable. I could even go back to something in this that would say just to that time frame alone, because that's very identifiable. And that's an easy thing for the state to say, oh, look, it was made from 1938 to 1945. It's World War II. It would be there and available to do that. That's easy. Some of these other things are very difficult because you're talking intrinsic value. So for what it's worth, Mr. Chairman, I throw that out for the committee's consideration. That might help.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the heart of the bill remains pretty good because of its breadth, right? We don't want people walking off with 9,000-year-old raven's tail weavings from karst caves on Prince of Wales Island that help prove just how long Southeast Alaska has been inhabited, or grass baskets from Western Alaska dig sites, just to go off and sell them. I don't understand how a prosecutor would prove that something had more significant historical value to the state than the general definition that committee staff read. But if it's an or, I guess it doesn't matter that element couldn't be proven. You could still prove the dollar value. So I'm okay with Senator Schauer's amendment as he read it.
All right. Is there any other? Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I actually like the addition. I realize that what Ed read, but going back to things other than the World War II crash sites, I think there are a lot of things, and hearing Ms. Bittner's concern about it's pretty tough to tag a monetary value, I do like that addition. It does give two options there.
Is there any further discussion? So Ms. Schroeder, just one more time, do you see any problem with phrasing the amendment as phrased $10,000 or of significant historical value to the state based on existing Alaska law and definitions of historical artifacts?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert in artifacts, and I don't know if I could articulate what significant historical value is, but someone at DNR may be able to do that. I apologize. The Department of Natural Resources may be able to do that, so that's why I'm deferring to them on whether or not that is something that can be articulated and therefore proven.
I'll go to Ms. Bittner. Ms. Bittner, do you have any? I was just mostly worried about the legal aspects of using those words, and I'm kind of okay with us going forward with this as it is, but Ms. Bittner, I'll give you the chance to chime in on that if you care to.
Yes, for the record, this is Judy Bittner with the Office of History and Archaeology, and through the chair to the committee. Yes, we do and have a methodology for determining historical significance to the state, and there is some established criteria and a process for evaluating historical items, and coming up with a
a determination and a finding of whether it's historically significant or not. And so there is a methodology for doing that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Hearing that, I will withdraw my objection to Senator Schauer's conceptual amendment number one, replacing the word $2,500 with $10,000 or of significant historical value to the state. If there is no other objection, conceptual amendment number one is adopted. And at this point, we're back with looking at amendment number one, labeled G.1. As amended. Thank you. As amended. And is there any further discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, I believe I had that objection. I will withdraw that objection. Is there any further discussion? So amendment number one, labeled G.1, is adopted. This will not be the last committee for this bill. There will still be, it'll be the last Senate committee, I believe, but there will be additional work in the House. It says good resources? I'm sorry, I missed that referral. All right. Are there further amendments? Seeing none, Ms. Bittner, I will give you, do you have any wrap-up on this bill as amended?
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you so much. At this point, I will look to Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just add, I believe this is a concurrent bill filed by the governor, so I do think it's in both bodies. I am pretty sure, so hopefully it would be able to make it through both. I'm not sure where it's at, just for the public.
All right, Senator Schauer, can I look to you for the will of the committee?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, I move that committee substitute.
One last thing, get on the record. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I interrupted the will of the committee. There was a question by Mr. Ogan about putting the word artifacts in here. I just wanted to confirm, probably with Department of Law, that we removed the word artifact because isn't the word artifact already included in the definition of a it was determined to be, I might get Mr. King over here to speak on that if necessary, but the word artifact is included in state historic, prehistoric, or archaeological resources, a definition of in Alaska law. Mr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, Staff Senator Holland. Yes, Mr. Chairman, the word artifact does appear in the definition of the phrase that you just discussed. Mr. Chairman, it's also the only place within the statute that word does exist. So defining the words that artifact further would only define it within the definition. And I would also point out that the definition that was ultimately suggested is also the definition found in the dictionary, and therefore it was assumed that there was no need for that additional language based on committee comments. But
I appreciate that. I just want to address that on the record. Mr. Ogan brought it up. But at this point, I will look to Senator Schauer for the will of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that committee substitute for Senate Bill 229, Work Order 32-GS2541/Gulf, as amended, be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Without objection, Senate Bill 229 has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes as amended, and we will empower alleged legal to perform conforming and technical changes to reach the will of the committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease to sign paperwork. Thank you. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. And at this point, we will bring Senate Bill 39 back before the committee. Senate Bill 39 is related to ballot custody, election tampering, and voter registration. This is the fourth hearing for Senate Bill 39 in this committee. We heard an overview of the changes in the new committee substitute during our last hearing. Senator Schauer, as the
sponsor of Senate Bill 39. Did you have any comments or want to invite Mr. Ogun to speak on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the top level, as I mentioned last time we heard this, we were not quite up to speed on all of the changes. This came back as a committee substitute that took about a month to get, working with other members down the aisle, or down the hall, I should say. So we are getting, I think, to a better place of having had more meetings to understand some of the changes, because we did not put all of them in. As you get a CS back, and Ledge Legal had some things that we weren't quite aware of, or maybe as we put it in. So I think we're to that point now. I'd like to invite, as you have Mr. Ogun here, to discuss it and entertain committee members' questions, but we are at a higher level now from the technicalities of the sectional analysis. I think this will be helpful.
All right. Thank you, Senator Schauer. Mr. Ogun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Scott Ogun, Senator Schauer's senior policy advisor. I'd like to maybe just do more of an executive summary. Last time we went over sectional analysis, which are long and tend to be boring and hard to understand, even for those of us that are giving them. So, but in an operating principle, we did with this bill, we applied a metric to everything with how to make our voting laws better. And that metric is make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. We worked with a number of people throughout a spectrum of politics putting this together. And I would respectfully submit that this may be, I'm hopeful that what we're doing here may be an example for the rest of the country. Because if you look at what's going on in the rest of the country, a lot of people are in their trenches, are kind of lobbing artillery shells on each other and making accusations. There's a lot of tin hats on with, you know, a whole lot of conspiracy theories. Some of them, I'm sure, well-founded. Others just because of the hype associated with it. And if you really look at it, our voting is just a cornerstone of our democracy and our republic. And if we don't, if the public does not have confidence in our voting system, we are in serious trouble. So to Senator Schauer's credit, he's a very good consensus builder, and we worked really hard with maybe some people that don't agree with us on some things to try to make it something that we can all look at, and we can possibly be, with no disrespect, the adults in the room for the rest of the country, you know. So that's the metrics of what we try to work on here. You know, the division's been plagued by data breaches, over registration, and a perception problem that nothing's being done to make our elections more secure and more open. And to their defense, they're following the law. The legislature is the policy setting body, and they do their best to follow the law, and we need to set that policy. So now that I'm done with that little lecture, I'll get on to what we do in the bill. Same day registration was a big hard thing for me to swallow, because if you look at what happened in Georgia, I don't know what's true and what's not, but there was allegations that people were crossing the lines in Georgia to vote in the last presidential election because they didn't have a 30-day limit like the state of Alaska does. So I'm like, no way. But it was one of those things that we had a lot of discussion on in our consensus building. And I said, fine, if you want to do same-day registration, we have to have sufficient proof. You have to sign an affidavit that you've lived in that district for more than 30 days under the penalty of perjury. And then with a question ballot only. So that's what we did in the law. So we made it easy to vote. We made it hard to cheat. We increased poll watcher opportunity. We did major changes to ballot security and chain of custody. That's really where we started on this journey, like, what, 4 years ago now? It was all about ballot security and chain of custody. There's a lot of loose things. The state of Alaska allows ballots to be destroyed in precinct. So what's to say that, you know, God willing, this never happened. What to say that somebody with nefarious intent knew that, you know, they wanted their candidate to get all the votes, they, you know, with all these extra ballots, just substitute them. I mean, we just want to take away any ability to cheat, make it easy to vote, hard to cheat. So we tightened up ballot security and chain of custody protocols. We want all the ballots to come back to a central location for destruction, not destroyed in precinct, for no other reason than for the perception that we're keeping control of all our ballots from the time they leave the Division of Elections to the time they get back. That builds confidence with the voters. We put a new section in on risk limiting audits. It's not a full forensic audit, but it requires a certain protocols that people look at to limit these risks by the Division of Elections. It puts sidebars on change of voting venues. If you recall, in a recent election, there was a candidate that had, because of COVID, the voting location was shut down at the last minute, and a lot of people didn't know where to vote. So we put sidebars of they have to give a 15-day notice, and if they don't, then that's an amendment that's coming. If they don't, there's a possible contested election. You'll see that in an amendment here up and coming. We included paying postage in advance on mail-out ballots. The problem with that is a lot of postage paid mail doesn't get date stamped. We need a date stamp on those ballots. So we put sidebars that it has to have a barcode, a U.S. Postal Service barcode. And we're also proposing that the division can contract with private sector companies. I'm not going to mention names here because I don't want to prejudice anybody or give anybody a leg up. But there are private sector companies that these things are pretty widely used. That it's kind of like when you order a package from Amazon. You know exactly where that package is at all times. You can get an application on your phone. These ballots can be the Division of Elections can track the ballot from the time it leaves to where it gets signed by the person and voted on and sent back. So that maintains some chain of custody on ballots that are mailed out. Absentee ballot clarifications are in Section 32. Requires, again, this online ballot tracking with either a U.S. with a Postal Service barcode. And the amended, we're going to have amendments coming that let the division contract with those private sector companies to get the app. Allows early counting of absentee ballots. The problem with that is, they never opened up absentee ballots before voting day, because then that information is out there. That's the best poll there is, right? And you're actually counting votes. So if we're going to do that, we want to make it a felony if you disclose that information to anybody and give a candidate some unfair information. So, but what that'll do is hopefully cut down on the time lapse between the time that the polls close and, you find out your results 3 or 4 weeks later. So let's see. It tightens up late arrival ballots with ballot tracking with USPS. There was a Nagy Act case where ballots came in after the day of the election, and it created a lot of consternation and some bad case law. So we closed that loophole. Voter signature identification technology. So we're going to eliminate the double signature for absentee ballots, but the caveat to that is that you've got to have signature verification. Ballot curing, something that the left is real fond of. I'm not, but we want to make it easy to vote. We want to make sure everybody that's qualified to vote gets to vote. If they make a simple mistake, like their signature isn't quite right, or they forgot to cross the T or dot an I, we give them an opportunity to cure that ballot. And if the bill's amended to include the ballot tracks, that's done like automatically. They'll send them a text saying, hey, you got a problem in your ballot, take care of it. So it's not this overly burdensome thing that Division of Elections does and drags elections on and on and on. It authorizes the division to mail out in smaller communities in different emergencies. One of the biggest things that this bill does that I'm really excited about is called open source voting. Open source voting is, well, we were contacted by a company that developed open source voting software and hardware. It's what that means is that anybody can look at the codes the day before the election, the day after the election. None of their hardware is proprietary, so it's off the shelf. The tabulators are, you can order them from Amazon. The computers off the shelf. Nothing's proprietary. And then the principle of that is let's just take everybody's tin hat off, right? There's no ambiguity about the data and conspiracies about there was manipulation going on with the machines. These particular machines and this company that does this is a nonprofit, and the machines cost half as much as the regular machines. They're not connected to the internet. They're not connected to a cell phone tower. It just eliminates all the ambiguity and all the accusations of manipulations by machines. And there might be other companies that do it. We're not specifying the company, but we're specifying the technology, and then let the people compete, the companies compete. It also creates new crimes for intentionally tampering, breaching, or hacking ballots. It also adjusts workers' pay to reflect a little bit more money to if they're having a hard time recruiting people. And it offers a permanent absentee ballot provision. I think that needs a little bit of work, but this version of the bill, you can sign up and get an absentee ballot, and it comes to you in perpetuity. We're probably going to offer an amendment that puts a limit on it, maybe 4 years. And also requires strict chain of custody for all the voting equipment, the tabulators, the computers, all that. And also has a section on increasing cybersecurity. So that's a little bit more of an executive summary of what's in the bill that might make a little bit more sense than reading section by section and with a sectional analysis. Anybody has any questions? I'm happy to.
Are there any questions from the committee for the sponsor or staff?
Three quick comments before the questions, Mr. Chair.
Senator Schauer.
Just for highlights, the RLA, the risk limiting audit, is different than forensic. I just keep wanting to push the language out because people keep saying forensic, and that is like a money trail or a computer specialist that would dive into the guts of a computer looking at the software. So we're talking a risk limiting audit, which is the one you would think of where you would look at ballot counts and registration and those kinds of things. So that's one. I bring this as an example of the current mailed election in June. Some of the problems we have, if we had this bill passed, something like this, it would take away many of the concerns, but we have a mass mailing for the first time in the state. We have no chain of custody, not sure if they're going to be able to do a ballot tracking system for all these mail-out ballots across the state, no signature verification, and the Division of Election told us on the record, no plan to cross-check those compromised voters, and there's over 100,000 of them at least that we know of, that their data is out there floating around the dark web that could be grabbed and used. So that's the danger of not having a bill like this passed with these safety checks, which is why we hope to get it through, although it won't help us in June. And then the last part is that when Scott says open source, like he said, the algorithm, that was a big part of the people upset about Dominion machines and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But in addition to the open source algorithms, another part of that, which we're requesting even this year, because the effective date wouldn't happen until after this election cycle, is to push the de-identified voter data. That was another thing that people were really upset about. They couldn't get the data so they could analyze it themselves. And we're saying, just push it. Once you de-identify it in this bill, just get everything out there for the world to see. It's transparent. There's no more questions about it. People can go, okay, well, at least the data is open and easily accessible, just to get people's faith restored that there's nothing hidden. That was the goal. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Hughes?
Yeah, I do have a couple questions. Thank you for that executive summary. I was crossing out questions I had from the last hearing because you answered them. But I still have a few remaining. And the first one, you mentioned the same-day registration option and then an affidavit would need to be signed. Is there also going to be a requirement that the person shows proof of residency and Alaskan address for 30 days as part of that signing affidavit? Or are they just filling out a form and signing their name?
Thank you, Senator Hughes, through the chair, Scott Ogan. They do have to provide sufficient proof, like a rent receipt or other sufficient proof, and it can only be done in person, and those ballots will only be question ballots. So the candidates will have some extra scrutiny. They can say, oh, these are all questions. They can look at them. They'll know that they registered that day. They can do what they need to do to verify that that person was actually living in the district at least 30 days ahead of time, because that's what it requires in state law.
Okay, excellent. Mr. Chair, I have different questions. Do you want to move around?
Senator, we'll go to Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at Section 23 of the bill, so it's page 11, and I'm looking specifically at lines 25 and 27. So this section of the bill is dealing with early voting, which I'm a big fan of. That's what I do for myself most years, voting. But it looks like, with the language on lines 25 and 27, it looks like we're switching it from regular early voting to all of our early voting stations would now be in-person absentee voting, which in my mind makes it a little bit harder to vote. And I'm also concerned because, again, a concern I had last time, I also want to preserve as much anonymity as possible once your vote has been cast. And so absentee voting and in-person absentee voting just as much pulls that back a little bit, because you've created that envelope there. I would much rather see us just do early voting, where it's just the same procedure as regular in-person voting. You walk in, you show your ID, and you get your ballot. So I'm trying to figure out why we're switching that language on lines 25 and 27 to say absentee ballots.
Senator Myers, through the chair, Scott Ogan. I don't have a lifeline here in other than maybe the boss's wife, who occasionally works in an election district, which is probably daggers in the back of my head here. And I'm not sure she's qualified as an expert other than being a great volunteer. But my memory, I've early voted a number of times, and I distinctly recall that I think I filled out an absentee ballot when I did it. And I wish we had the director here to answer that question.
She's on the line.
I'm sorry, I might have the wrong screen up.
I've done it both ways. There are differences.
I'm sorry. So, Senator Myers, do you have a follow-up on that?
Just to Mr. Ogan's point, it is different. There are differences because I've done it both ways. The Fairbanks borough elections, for example, if you walk in and want to vote early, they do early voting up until just a few days prior, and then they switch it to in-person absentee because they want to be able to take those voter rolls and move them out to the precincts so that they don't have to go back and double-check the signatures to see who's voted, who hasn't, making sure people don't double-vote. The state of Alaska, on the other hand, does early voting all the way up to and through Election Day, and then they go back later and double-check the signatures on the voter rolls. They don't do in-person absentee unless you request it or you're going to be voting a question ballot. So there are differences.
All right, and I see we do have Division of Elections, Ms. Gail Finumiai, and if you wanted to provide some insight on the discussion we have right now.
Certainly, Gail Finumiai from the Division of Elections, through the chair, Senator Meyer, and committee members. Senator Meyer is correct. There are two very distinct processes here. There are differences between early voting and absentee in-person voting. Early voting is what takes place in our five regional offices. And as Senator Meyer stated, you show your identification, you verify your residence address as it is showing in the state's voter registration system, and a voter certificate prints out, it's signed, you're issued your ballot, and you get to cast your vote right then and there, and the voter is given instantaneous voter history. If somebody absentee in person is what happens at our non-regional offices, and there are a variety of those kind, you may be familiar with some that have multi-district ballots. Some are single district sites. And some actually do have all 40 House district ballots, like the airports on Election Day, and some other smaller sites like the universities. But those are strictly absentee in-person locations. It's still voting early, but voters at those locations are required to fill out the absentee in-person oath and affidavit voter certificate, and then those are returned to the division, and the voter's eligibility is determined once that ballot is received and reviewed by the absentee review board.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Gail Fanumiai. Senator, been a long day. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Chairman. What's his name? couldn't resist. I guess a couple of questions about the open source notion. I'm only familiar with one company that does open source software for voting tabulators and the like. So if the sponsor's office is able to get back with the names of a couple, I just want to make sure we're not inadvertently writing in sole source by operation of general law. But then I guess the question I have is that as I read the bill, nothing in it does away with paper ballots or for the special needs voting machines, voter verifiable paper trails. And so everything is recountable to the extent we can use the word auditable. It's auditable. If open source software isn't the best software, what's our reason for requiring it? If it crashes the machines more often or has more hiccups that have to be verified, I would think that potentially decreases voter confidence. Why require this one rather than require the best and maintain our ability always to go back and check and verify and make sure the result is good?
I'll take that, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right.
Please proceed.
Thank you. So, Senator Keel, good questions. We have no intent, obviously. We didn't even, we started this 3.5 years ago. We didn't even know there was such thing as open source software or machines or even companies that were working on it. We'll certainly get back with you with how many. I know the one that reached out to us is looking for federal certification, which they all would have to meet. So I would assume that if it was to be one that we might eventually use, then they would certainly be federally certified or else they wouldn't be usable, which would be the same standard any other company uses. So I would, if they're comfortable passing that and any others like the current ones we use, then I would be okay with it, because that should answer your question to how good they are because they've passed that. To answer the second part kind of generically of your question, which is why do we want to do this? It's one of the most consistent things we have seen from the public as we talk about restoring faith in the system is the impression at least, of the lack of transparency from a company that now when the lieutenant governor says, well, we're going to have to rely on the machines to tell us who wins. Everybody's like, whoa, because the algorithm has to be run. Well, it's proprietary. They won't share it with us. We can't look at it. That's a bit of a problem, because not only is that a problem for us with oversight, but it's a problem for the public because they go where they would like to know. They would like to have the comfort and knowledge that they can look at that software and go, yep, not being manipulated, not attached to anything. It was one of the most repeated comments that we got from people was distrust of the current machines. And I know this is a national thing where he mentioned it very appropriately. There's some conspiracies, some probably founded, some probably not. But if we're going to go down the path of spending money, because we will have to anyways, then it should be something that is going to assuage the concerns of as many of our citizens as we can. And allowing them, and you may remember this, well, maybe not, it was State Affairs, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to go quick, is that in State Affairs, the Division of Elections Director, briefed us, we asked the question, could we do or provide the software off of a random machine before the election, the day before, and then the day after? She said we could. Although you'd have to go through Dominion and whether they're going to release that and look at the machines is a whole other problem of proprietary information. And that becomes one of our problems is if we can't look at that, the state doesn't have access or the ability to look at it, which we would with an open source company, then that goes back to, well, what's hidden? What can't we see? So while we may or may not all agree on what was out there or not, without question, a good portion of the public is very concerned about the transparency And the push to do this is to just say, hey, find a company somewhere that's going to allow it to be completely open source, de-identify the data, push it for every citizen that wants it, be done with it. Because it is tearing us apart, quite frankly. And I think we have better options. And I hope that, a long answer, Mr. Chairman, but I hope that answers Senator Peel's question.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. At this point, I tell you what, we've already gone over. Appreciate the Nancy and Talia for hanging around and the rest of the staff. I do appreciate the bill sponsor for working down the hall across the aisle on this bill. But at this point, we're going to set the bill aside. I am going to set an amendment deadline for noon on Wednesday, April 13th. We already have quite the many amendments. There will probably be a few days of just going through amendments on this bill. And so it'll be time for lots more discussion on the bill. But at this point, I will set Senate Bill 39 aside. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Wednesday, April 13th at 1:30 p.m. And we are adjourned at 3:13 p.m.